Hello, I'm Eric Corman, Communications Director at League of Education Voters. In this podcast, we interview policymakers, partners, and thought leaders to spotlight education policies, research, and practices so that together we can create a brighter future for every Washington student. A community activist for more than 40 years, Sharon Tomiko Santos was elected to the Washington State House in 1998 to represent the 37th Legislative District in South Seattle and Renton. Representative Santos chairs the House Education Committee and serves on the Consumer Protection and Capital Budget Committees. She also serves appointments to the Washington State Education Opportunity Gap Accountability and Oversight Committee, the ELGOAC, and the Washington Work Integrated Learning Advisory Committee. Representative Santos has served on dozens of boards and foundations, including the Boys and Girls Clubs of King County, National Asian Pacific American Women's Forum, and the University of Washington Business and Economic Development Program Board of Ambassadors. A graduate of the Evergreen State College and of Northeastern University, Santos has worked in the banking industry, on staff to local public elected officials, and in senior management positions for nonprofit organizations. Thank you for all you do. You are really quite involved in the community. It's fantastic.
Well, thank you, Eric, and thank you for what you do. I'm very excited to be participating in this.
One of League of Education Voters' main priorities is special education. How do you envision the legislature responding to special education needs from the community?
You know, I'm so glad that you asked that question. I am the daughter of a special education teacher from the Seattle area, and I think my mom's story really illustrates our evolving understanding of students with special needs and how we can best support them in their education. Mom, typical for her generation, was educated in the 1950s, and when she went to work, she served in an institution, a segregated institution where parents of special needs kids sent their children to be educated. We referred to those schools as specialty schools, and it was the notion that students with special needs not only had different support needs, but they actually should have separate education goals. Later, Mom became a pioneer in this whole movement called mainstreaming, where we had classrooms in our conventional schools, but segregated classrooms for special needs kids. That way, the idea at the time was that both special education students and general education students would have opportunities, albeit more limited, to engage with one another. I think that if my mother were still alive and teaching today, that she would be an ardent proponent of the program of inclusion that we hear so much about. Mm-hmm. But the truth of the matter is that we've done a lot of talking, and we think we know what the best practices are, but we've never really seen this brought to scale so that we can work out kinks. And so there was a proposal during this last legislative session offered by Representative Jerry Paulette that I think really captures a good process for initiating policies and practices of inclusion in our schools for our special education students while on the way to making this a statewide effort. So the idea is to continue working with our special education parents and advocates and students to implement these best practices and procedures, to identify a small group of willing school districts that would voluntarily spearhead this effort and allow us to learn from both their successes as well as their mishaps so that we can roll this out in a more thoughtful, deliberative, and hopefully successful way for all special education students statewide.
Full disclosure here, I am a parent of a student receiving special education services in the Seattle School District. So yes, I'm particularly interested in that. So this would be basically a pilot program? Is that what this would do?
You could call it a pilot program. We really were labeling them as demonstration projects because there are many of us who believe that we do know what will work for our kids. And so this would be to demonstrate that these practices and these procedures will result in better outcomes, not just for our students with special needs, Eric, but also for our general education students as we expose both gen ed and special needs students to each other and do the co-learning model. Because, frankly, both young people as well as grown-up people learn better when they're learning with their peers than apart.
Yeah, absolutely. And it sounds like, in a way, I mean, one way of looking at individual education programs, or IEPs, is that you're tailoring education to what works best for a student. Wouldn't it be great if every gen ed student could have their own IEP as well?
Absolutely, and we are certainly going to be moving in that direction if I have anything to say about it.
That's great. So one thing that you've been working on for years, and one of your biggest achievements, is House Bill 1541, the Opportunity Gap Bill. What are next steps for that?
That really was a monumental achievement, and it was the result of many years of work on the part of stakeholders. And so while I get to have my name on the bill, the credit really belongs to caring and committed parents and educators who understood that we had a tremendous opportunity gap, and that unless we started to squarely address some of the key fundamental issues that were contributing to that opportunity gap, we would not only continue to perpetuate it, we would probably actually see it grow. So the primary next step for 1541 is monitoring the legislation for faithful implementation. Mm-hmm. And so by that, I can identify maybe a couple of areas where we actually have been watching the implementation process. Just last year, the Superintendent of Public Instruction issued the rules and regulations around discipline policy, which is a very big deal. And part of the reason it is a big deal is because it recognizes and enshrines in state law that our students have a constitutional right that is inherent to an education, and that under no circumstances may the state actually divorce a student from that constitutional right. Mm-hmm. And so it has been a very long implementation tail, with the superintendent not only having to write the rules, but also gearing up 295 school districts to recognize, well, you can suspend or expel a student. We don't like that. That's the worst case scenario. Mm-hmm. But even in those cases, you still are on the hook for providing the education for that student. So Wouldn't it be better if you actually kept that student engaged in the school and in the classroom and in the learning process? So we're very hopeful about that implementation over the next academic year. Mm-hmm. Another area that we did some work, as you might recall, is around data disaggregation, so that we could see how students are performing. And we have written into law and directed the superintendent to use as the N size, if you will, for both reporting and accountability, an N size of 10. Mm-hmm. Now, that's presented some problems, and we've had to go back and forth with the superintendent around both making sure we have small N sizes so we can not hide problems, mm-hmm. but also not make the N size be a reason for breaking student confidentiality. So that has been a little bit of a fine balance in terms of implementation. But I'm very happy to say that because of the work that we did, the State Board of Education, along with the Superintendent of Public Instruction, has moved to incorporate the N size of 10 idea into the new Washington State Student Achievement Index. Mm-hmm. So that should be a much more robust and rich view of how our system is performing, because that's what accountability always has been about, is how is our system performing for each student, not how is each student performing. Mm-hmm. I think the last area that is important from the standpoint of 1541 is we talked a lot about the need to recruit and retain an educator workforce that looks like the students we serve in Washington State. That's taken a little longer, but I'm very pleased to report that this year the legislature did finally adopt the Educator Workforce Shortage Bill, which itself is fairly comprehensive in terms of trying to pull all of the disparate parts and policies and programs and agencies into something that is more cohesive and comprehensive to benefit the student. And in this case, I mean the student who is going to be our future teacher. Mm-hmm. As a small example, one of the things that we do is we consolidated all of the student loan conditional scholarship programs under one roof. so that you, if you wanted to be a teacher, mm-hmm. wouldn't have to have pre-knowledge of, oh, if I want to be a science teacher, I have to go look for scholarship money at the Student Achievement Council. Oh, but if I am a professional that's just trying to enter into the field and I bring specialized skills and knowledge to perhaps be a CTE teacher, then I'm going to the Professional Educator Standards Board. That didn't make sense because if you want to be a teacher, that's what you know is I want to be a teacher and where can I go for a one-stop shop? Mm-hmm. Those are some areas. I think the only other thing that I would say is very, very important to me and I think to our students overall is how to move forward with the Washington Integrated Student Support Protocol.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that next.
Well, I'm very excited that the superintendent has completed their duty around developing the protocol. So the protocol is now in place. Mm-hmm. The next step really is to help the superintendent educate the districts about this powerful tool in the toolbox and to help create an understanding of why this actually helps move the needle for students in their communities. And so we've tried over the last couple of years to provide a little bit of a sweetener, if you will, or an incentive for adopting the WISP, and that was to use the LAP dollars, which most districts find to be the most flexible of dollars.
Learning Assistance Program.
Learning Assistance Program. Thank you. Uh-huh. They find it to be the most flexible of dollars, but that's not exactly true. Mm-hmm. So they can choose from a menu of different programs to assist students. And the idea of providing the Learning Assistance Program dollars as a sweetener is to say, you know, we can make this really flexible. And you can start with that menu, but you don't have to be restricted to the things on the menu because maybe your students don't need what's on the menu. Mm-hmm. So if we give you full flexibility to spend LAP dollars as you want to meet the needs of your students, mm-hmm. the only thing that we will be inflexible about is the process. So in short, the WISP protocol is very simple. You start with a needs assessment of your student body. Mm-hmm. You let that inform how you want to spend the dollars. And the spending of the dollars needs to be a community exercise where you both go out into the community to find out what other resources exist in the community that perhaps you can bring into your school building or into your district and really get twice the bang for your buck, because oftentimes those are public services as well. Think of public health, for example.
Sure.
And to engage in a community process around how you're going to spend the LAP dollars. And then finally, the last piece really is to keep data so that we know that your decision around how you spent the LAP dollars actually is benefiting the student and not just, oh, your favorite brother-in-law's program that you decided to bring in.
Got it. So there's accountability built into this.
Exactly.
Well, speaking of accountability, you have been deeply involved in the Educational Opportunity Gap Oversight and Accountability Committee, the EOGOAC. What's next for the committee for the rest of 2019 and into 2020?
Well, again, I think mostly we are looking at issues around monitoring 1541 with fidelity, and there is still ongoing work in that respect. I think one of the things that we are very grateful about is as word of our success has spread, there has been a great demand to engage with the EOGOAC, almost more than the members can handle because, again, most of the members are stakeholders from the community. Mm-hmm. But we have open public meetings on a monthly basis, and we get different organizations coming in to talk to us about either great programs or great challenges that they face. Mm-hmm. An example that, again, we saw some movement this year in the legislative process was a unique group of parents who are linguistically isolated or their communities are linguistically isolated. Mm-hmm. but these were also parents of special needs children. Mm-hmm. So if you can imagine the challenges that a parent or a special needs student who is fully capable of understanding English and our American society, you can probably begin to guess at the layers of challenges that our immigrant and refugee parents of special education students face. Mm-hmm. We were able to adopt policy this year that directs the Superintendent of Public Instruction to work with the Office of the Education Ombuds and ensure that we understand what are the best practices for engaging families and communities of special needs students so that we could all be moving in concert in support of those students' needs.
Are you talking about House Bill 1130?
Exactly.
Thank you so much for your help in passing that, by the way.
Oh, absolutely. It was very important. You might notice how it evolved over the legislative session. One of the things that we identified with both special needs and also with language access issues is the fact that students who are deaf often learn a recognized language called ASL. Mm-hmm. But it is a language that is separate from our oral language. And it didn't make sense to try and identify only non-English speakers as the persons needing access to our programs and services, when in fact language is a vital part of how any student learns. Mm-hmm. So we incorporated that community as well.
And let's talk about your learning. I'm curious about your own personal education journey. I mean, you talked about your mother and her work in special education. But what about you? What worked well during your journey and what didn't?
I was very fortunate, and I still am very fortunate, to represent the district in which I was raised. Mm. Then, as today, it was a very, very diverse district. It was a district and is a district that is racially, ethnically, religiously diverse. We have a very high immigrant population. More than one in four persons was born in another country. We have a great diversity of economic status and educational attainment because of all of these factors. And it's a community that's very rich in history. Today, we often think of the heart of the Jewish community, for example, of the Puget Sound or King County area to be Mercer Island. But in fact, it started in my district. Mm-hmm. And we have from Langston Hughes, which was a former synagogue, down to Rainier Beach, where we have many of the Sephardic Jewish community. Very, very rich heritage that continues on today. I share all of that because that was very profoundly influential in how I see the world. The people who raised me, the communities that helped raise me, imprinted on my worldview, my perspective of social relations. So as a result, I really learned that the educators that I was accustomed to really responded well to this great diversity. I remember, for example, one of my favorite high school language arts teachers, Mr. Paul Nicholas. I will never forget him. And he was part, too, of the great diversity of our community, our LGBTQ community. Some of the readings that he exposed us to in high school were not standard fare. And to this day, one of my favorite novels that he shared with us is called America is in the Heart. It is a novel. It's semi-autobiographical and partially set here in Seattle. And it's about the Filipino immigrant story, how they came to the United States, how they were engaged in union building. Everyone knows about Cesar Chavez and the Farm Workers Union. But in fact, before the Farm Workers Union, Cesar Chavez worked with Filipino labor leaders in the lettuce fields of California to engage in the first strikes. Mm-hmm. And to the seafood industry here in Seattle and all of the Alasqueros who went north. But The title of the story is really a love ode to what it means to be an American. And it really is about those philosophical points that it's not about your color or your race or your religion or where you've come from, what language you speak and what abilities you bring to the table. It is about the way you look at the world and the way you engage with other people on a basis of human rights. So to me, that really is a perfect example of what worked well, is teachers responding to the students that are in their classroom using local material that becomes relevant. Not just relevant in terms of, can I hear myself in the stories, but it's also relevant to who I am and what I want to be and how I can be that person, a contributing member of our society. So that was for me, and I will always so much appreciate Mr. Nicholas for just his love of teaching and his love of his students. And I contrast that then with a different experience. When I was in high school, the Seattle School District faced a federal court order to desegregate. And while my high school was considered one of the most naturally desegregated high schools in the country, the district as a whole was not.
And what high school did you go to?
Oh, I'm a proud Quaker, Franklin High School in Seattle.
I'm great.
And during this period where we were engaged in a community conversation around how are we going to deal with this federal order, one of the things, and so this was one of my first political lessons, one of the things that we really embraced was the notion of local voices, local control, that we knew better than a federal judge sitting on a bench in San Francisco what our communities looked like and what our communities needed. And that was particularly true, I think, for the communities of color. So we then embarked on developing an alternative plan that was a voluntary busing system. Now, any of us who were involved in the deseg movement at the time, I think over all of these decades, probably have altered our thinking one way or another. I know that I have, certainly. And while I still believe that it was the right thing to do to develop a local plan, the truth is that the plan that we developed, which was based on busing, which was really sort of the option of choice all across the nation, presented a greater burden to students of color. But we didn't know. So that's me speaking with 2020 hindsight. At the time, it was, well, we will engage in a busing program and ensure that there is more diversity within each of the schools in Seattle, which meant that I took a 45-minute school bus ride from my home in South Seattle to school north in the morning, and then a similar trip back. And what doesn't work is if I had been an athlete, which I was not, I could not participate in any athletic events. If I wanted to engage in any school-based extracurricular activities, I could not do so. If I needed extra help, I couldn't seek the assistance of my teachers after school because otherwise, as the daughter of working parents, I wouldn't be able to get home. But the exposure to this school in the North End that I will leave nameless was one where the student body was predominantly white, probably 90 to 95% white.
Wow.
And the teaching core was similar. Up to that point, I had always been a honors math student. I don't know why. I enjoyed math. I still enjoy numbers, but at the time, I was always an honors student and enjoyed my math classes. But when I moved to this North End school and I started having trouble with, I can't remember if it was calculus or pre-calculus or whatever the math class was, the teacher's attitude was, basically, you Asian students are all math whizzes.
Oh.
you should be able to get this no problem. And it absolutely was a killjoy of my love of math because I couldn't understand this particular subject. I remember it was matrices, so I still don't understand matrices as a math concept. Yeah. And so I contrast those two teachers, and I contrast the experiences where I fully felt engaged in my community at Franklin, and I fully felt like, I'm not even sure, a visitor, not even a visitor. It was a process. I was a part of the industrialized assembly line that we call education, and not more than a cog.
Yeah, I was thinking about that, a factory model almost.
Exactly.
Well, given your experience both personally and legislatively working in education policy, if you could wave a magic wand and design a system any way that you think could work best, what would that look like?
Well, Eric, I have given that a lot of thought.
I'm sure you have.
And I will go back to the statutory goal of basic education in Washington State. And what we say in the statute is that basic education is an evolving program of instruction that is designed so that students are equipped with the skills and knowledge to be good citizens, to be able to contribute to their economic well-being and that of their families and their communities, to be respectful and responsible global citizens, understanding different perspectives. And that's a tall order.
Yeah.
So how do we create a system that meets the needs of each and every student to hit those marks? Because those marks are going to be different for every student. My thoughts are arranged around the proverbial three-legged stool. So the first is around skills and knowledge. And it's not just skills and knowledge that perhaps you or I, or more appropriately, our parents and grandparents learned of reading, writing, arithmetic, but it's really transferable skills and knowledge that we don't hold our kids to. Well, you have to learn this level of science in biology or this level of math in algebra. But it's understanding the mathematical equations. It's understanding the scientific method that becomes important. And so while it's true, we still want our students to graduate being able to read and write with comprehension and to communicate effectively, I think what we really want to move it towards is what is often referred to as mastery-based learning or competency-based learning. It still has standards, but the focus is really on adopting a perspective of student agency. When you see fully developed mastery-based or competency-based systems, the student knows what are my learning goals and where am I struggling. They become the problem solvers and the agents in their own learning as they are moving towards, whether it's, again, math or science or reading. They can cite the concepts that they are trying to learn.
Mm-hmm. Right, learning how to learn, learning how to think, basically.
Precisely. The second leg of our three-legged stool is really around project-based or applied learning. The sit-and-get method, most people will agree, whether you are a little person or a big person, is not the most effective way of learning. It may be the most effective way of delivery, and it may be the most cost-efficient way of delivery, but it is not the most effective way to learn. And we have a constant battle, not only in the state, but in our society across the United States, with the relative benefit of cost-effectiveness versus quality outcomes. Mm-hmm. We think we want both, but we're not willing to pay for the quality outcome. So that's always something that we have tensions around.
Yeah, at LEV, we tend to say, are we focusing on the adults or are we focusing on the students?
Exactly. Or I would say, are we focusing on the dollar? Or are we focusing on the demonstration of learning?
Yes.
So when we talk about the dollar, that includes our taxpayers as well. Mm-hmm. Are we willing to pay for that quality public education system that, frankly, each and every one of us in society depends upon? Whether you have children or you do not, whether you have a student who's in the public system or not, we all eventually rely on the output of the public education system. Mm-hmm. So when we talk about applied learning, the most convenient way for people to understand this is that if, for example, you have more than one child in your family, whether it's your children or your grandchildren or maybe your cousins, you will soon realize that not every student or every child is the same. Some really do prefer to curl up in a corner and read books. I can recall the first time one of my nephews started to be more independent as a toddler, and he completely took apart a toy that wasn't supposed to be taken apart, but then he put it back together again. Hmm. And he could not have been more than two. So it won't surprise you that today he is an engineer, mm-hmm. because he had that proclivity. And we, I think, try to force students back to that industrial factory model that you referenced earlier. We try to make our students comport to a one-size-fits-all learning system. And it's no wonder that we have different types of learning gaps all over the place. I do believe, honestly, that every student benefits from applied learning because it's a more powerful teacher. But here's how it can also be a harbinger of culturally competent education. And this is one of the things that people often miss. Imagine, for example, in some of our remote school districts or perhaps even our tribal communities. There is a tradition in our tribal communities of a canoe journey, mm-hmm. which has a lot of history, mm-hmm. it's a lot of culture, a lot of art. You have to also learn a lot about nature as you are learning to figure out what kind of wood you're going to use to make your canoe. And what are you going to do with the excess pieces? You know, every piece that you carve off or strip off of a tree can be reused in another fashion. Mm-hmm. So there are many great lessons there. But it doesn't stop there, because eventually you're going to launch that canoe.
Yes.
And you have to understand the science of navigating through waters. And you have to understand the pool of the tides. You have to understand if part of your journey is harvesting food from the sea. Mm-hmm. What might you find? And what are the foods, just like on land, that you want to avoid? So to me, applied learning delivers math as you're constructing your canoe, science as you're both creating the canoe, but you're also doing the journey itself. Mm-hmm. You can incorporate your language arts by journaling on your journey. You learn a lot about history and culture as you are accomplishing all of this. So to me, it's a very rich way of incorporating a variety of disciplines rather than saying, okay, Eric, now it's time for math. Go to your math class. Or now it's time for science. We're going to learn about whatever. Mm-hmm. Applied learning or project-based learning, I think, is a very rich delivery system, mm-hmm. as is the third leg of our three-legged stool. And that's where we really get to the notion that is often depicted as college and career. Mm. Is not a term that I am particularly fond of because it leaves a student and our system with a bifurcated view of what happens post-secondary. Mm-hmm. Because even though we say college and career, it really is often college or career.
Right.
when in fact what we should be focusing in on, particularly in the K-12 system, when we have them captured, is on the love of learning and how is learning applied now and in the future. And so work-integrated learning is about keeping the student in the center. This is not about workforce development needs. That's an adult education mindset. We're talking still about teenagers and sometimes tweens, where we want them to start as early as possible thinking about what are the possibilities, what am I interested in. I've always found it to be remarkable that when you have a little person, every adult in the world says, and what do you want to be when you grow up? Mm-hmm. But as soon as they turn 12 or 13, we stop asking that question, which is exactly the point when we should be asking deeper, more probing questions about, oh, you want to be an astronaut. Well, what does it take to be an astronaut? Mm-hmm. What kind of classes do you have to prepare for?
Yes.
Do they have those available in your school? Or you want to be a basketball star? Gosh, how do you go about doing that? I'm sure you're very talented on the basketball court, but what else do you need to know? So work-integrated learning must always begin with the individual student, because what's going to drive that student is his or her own individual interests, even if they change. That's good. That's why we're talking about competency-based learning, mastery-based learning, transferable skills and knowledge. It doesn't matter if you're going to be a basketball star or you're going to be an astronaut. I'm sorry, you need math in both of those professions.
Yes, you do.
So starting with the student and in an age-appropriate fashion, exposing them to how their academics are relevant to future career options and choices and interests. Whether that is beginning with career exploration or whether that is providing opportunities for them to develop career-based skills, and most important, providing them, each and every student, with the opportunity to engage in one or hopefully more external opportunities so that they can actually see where, yeah, that biology class is really helpful if I want to become an environmental scientist. Mm-hmm. And they have those kinds of programs at the Port of Seattle, where we're actually giving students the opportunity to see the relevance of why you're in school. Perhaps the number one reason that students cite for dropping out of school is, it wasn't very interesting to me.
Yes.
That's why we have to engage the students where they are. Now, for some of our students, there are two elements that are really important about the work-integrated learning opportunity, especially for many of our low-income students and our immigrant students. There is a high level of expectation that the student is going to return home to perform some other responsibility, whether it's to go to work. I was one of those kids. I had to go to work in order to help contribute to my family's income. Mm-hmm. So my paycheck was important. Without realizing it at the time, it was reinforcing a lot of finance skills for me because I was a cashier, but I looked at it as a job. So whether it's family responsibility, like taking care of younger siblings, or whether it actually is going to a paid job, having an opportunity for students to have a paid external opportunity is going to be a higher priority for some of our students. Mm-hmm. The second thing is going to be, I would argue, important for every one of our students. It's just that some of our students have naturally greater access to an external mentor or guide. The question becomes, what is the purpose of that external mentor or guide? You're a dad. You know that when you tell your kid, you got to do this, they're like, yeah, went in one ear and out the other. Or, I want you to do this because I want you to be successful. Well, dad, that's your job. You're my dad. Mm-hmm. I expect you to say that, but that doesn't mean I'm going to listen to you, right? Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean as much. The same thing holds true for our teachers. You get paid to tell me that. You get paid to tell me I'm bright. But if you take somebody who has no skin in the game other than I want to develop a relationship with you, all of a sudden you and I could have been saying the same thing to our kid, and all of a sudden it means something because a third party has validated the parent and the teacher.
Yes.
So that three-legged stool, Eric, is my vision for moving the state of Washington in a comprehensive way to support each and every student's educational interest. And you talked about an IEP. That's what we need to move to. But what we call it today is a high school and beyond plan.
Sharon Tomiko Santos is the chair of the House Education Committee and represents the 37th Legislative District. Representative Santos, thank you so much for letting me drop by.
Thank you very much. I very much enjoyed this conversation.
And thank you for listening. To learn more about League of Education Voters or to support our work, please visit educationvoters.org.